This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, I'm here with Joel Peterson from Ravenswood Wines. Ravenswood Wines are, the biggest producer of Zinfandel in the US. I understand you're doing some work at the moment to track down the history of Zinfandel and clones, etc. Where did Zinfandel originally start? Most people call it, the Primitivo grape from Italy.
Well, we actually have done a lot of genetic research. A woman named Carol Meredith really figured out how to analyze grapes to determine where they came from. For instance, she determined that Cabernet Sauvignon was a cross between Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet Franc, a red grape and a white grape. Mm-hmm. And she used this data to look back at Zinfandel and its various antecedents. And it turns out Primitivo is genetically the same as Zinfandel, but it's a very different clonal variation. And she looked at grapes in Croatia, and people thought that this grape might be Plavac Mali. It turns out Plavac Mali is a son of Zinfandel, and with some searching, she found a grape called Zerlianats Castellanski, which is genetically identical to Zinfandel and to Primitivo. It looks slightly different than Primitivo in that it's much more uneven ripening, which is very much like Zinfandel is. And based on the data that she's been able to collect and the kinds of variations that are in Croatia, we believe that this grape came to Croatia. Would it be surprising if it went across the Adriatic to Italy, which is, Puglia is really right across the Adriatic from there. We believe it went there sometime in the 1700s, early 1800s. Came to California via a collection in Austria, which was from the Austro-Hungarian Schönbrunn collection. And it turned out that Croatia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so it would be one of the grapes that was collected. So it makes sense based on everything we can determine genetically that the grape is from Croatia. California's version is probably from Croatia, as is Italy's. They've been separated for a long time. They've been selected for different things. So they look slightly different at this particular juncture, but they are basically clonal variations of the same grape.
Okay. How many clonal variations do you think there are of Zinfandel?
There are probably a number. I'm working on a big project with UC Davis where we have something called the Zinfandel Heritage Vineyard, where we have collected a number of selections of vines that were planted before 1920 in California. We currently have 90 selections. We have narrowed it down to 20 that are really interesting variations on that grape. They've been planted. We are looking and measuring everything we can measure about these grapes, and we're also making wine out of them. It's very early in the process yet. I'd say it's a good 10-year project. It's one of those long-term projects where I'll be old and gray and long in tooth before it's done, if I'm lucky. And it looks to me like there are at least three distinct variations based on very early data. But we'll see. I mean, it's an interesting project. It's really fascinating, and it will give us the clonal knowledge we need to plant better Zinfandel in the future, or at least match clonal variation with site in a way that's the most constructive.
Zinfandel, California's grape. They're trying to pass a law recently to make it California's grape.
And they're going to make it California's historical grape, and there's no doubt that it's been tied up in the history of California viticulture for a long time. It arrived in California in 1854. And very rapidly became the most rapidly widely planted grape in California. And by 1880, there were 30,000 acres of it. To give you an idea, there are about 50,000 acres of it planted now. So it was a very, very important grape in California. And it became important because it fits with the environment. If Cabernet is Bordeaux's grape and Pinot Noir is Burgundy's grape and Shiraz maybe is Australia's grape, although it might be claimed by the Rhone as well, Zinfandel is clearly California's grape. It is the right grape in the right environment. California has a environment where the rains stop in June, the humidity stays low all summer, and the rains don't stop well into September, which is exactly what this grape needs. It didn't survive in Croatia because it was too humid, and there were lots of other regions where it didn't grow very well. But the balance of where it grows and the kinds of expression that it gets And the kinds of wine it produces are perfect for California. So it is, you know, clearly California's grape, whether it be historical or not, it's the right grape for the right environment.
So what sort of problems do you have with Zinfandel growing it?
Well, you know, it has the uneven ripeness, which is the issue of if you're not very careful about how you pick it, you get wines that are extremely high in alcohol, which is exactly what happens, and sometimes with residual sugar in it. If you pick it too early, you end up getting inconsequential wines that taste sort of like picnic style, you know, lightweight Beaujolais. Yeah. If you're not careful, when it's a young vine, it will produce huge numbers of grapes. It'll produce, you know, 8 or 9 tons an acre, which is why it's really good for making white Zinfandel, because you can, you know, make this really cheap plonk with high volumes. But it is also the strength of the grape in the sense that when it gets very old, it still is productive, meaning it'll produce about 3 tons an acre or less, which is exactly what you need for producing, you know, good balanced red wine out of it. And it has a propensity to rot easily in a high humidity environment or when there's rain. Fortunately, in California, that doesn't happen very often.
Do you have much disease pressure from plants or even diseased vines themselves? Because if the vine's been in the ground for 100 years, they must have picked up something.
You know, it's remarkable. You know, leaf roll virus didn't get introduced into California until the 1920s. So those vines that were planted earlier are still quite clean. The vines themselves have held up very well. You know, we've been through several scourges of one variety or another in California, and the first vines in California were planted in the 1850s. They had to be replanted in the 1880s because of phylloxera, but mm-hmm. those replantings are the ones that we're now getting grapes from.
How come they weren't pulled out during Prohibition? I thought a lot of vines were pulled.
Well, Prohibition was really remarkable for Zinfandel. In fact, there was a little bit more Zinfandel planted during Prohibition because it became the favorite grape of home winemakers. A lot of home winemakers were making wine. In fact, 3 years after Prohibition, there was still more home wine being made than was being made commercially in the entire state of California. But one of the favorite grapes was Zinfandel. And there was a lot of Zinfandel that did get pulled out, but Zinfandel was in flatlands where, you know, things like fruit trees grew better or row crops. But the Zinfandel that was really good remained, and that's one of the things that makes Zinfandel so good in California today, because it was highly selected, dry-farmed vines in the right soils that balanced with the grapevine. And home winemakers knew this, and so they grew grapes for them, and as a consequence, Zinfandel survived the Prohibition.
The old vines, you know, you're talking about 100-year-old vines earlier, are they bush vines, or are they on trellising now, or what's the story there?
No, most of the vines that are being grown that are old vines are all bush vines, or head-pruned, or gobelet. I mean, it's a really old-style French pruning system.
Yeah.
And it's actually perfect for Zinfandel because Zinfandel is a slightly larger clustered variety. And if you grow it on trellising, the clusters tend to hang on top of one another, so they don't get the right light. They also tend to rot more easily.
Okay.
So bush vining, if you were, was the right way to do it. You can also control crop levels better that way.
I presume all the new plantings are going on to trellising, though.
No. In fact, a lot of the new plantings that are going in that are Zinfandel are being put on bush vines for the very reason that it's a more appropriate trellising system for this particular grape.
You can't mechanically harvest a bush vine, though, can you?
If you bring it up high enough, you know, and you don't turn it into a tiny bush vine like some of them were in the old days, you can mechanically harvest. But it's not the perfect form for mechanical harvesting, no. So everything that we do is hand harvested, which I think is a better harvesting system in any case, as long as we have labor.
The perception of the Sideways movie is that it drove Pinot Noir sales. Did that influence the Zinfandel sales? You don't make any Pinot Noir, do you?
I don't make Pinot Noir.
Is that because it's a wimpy wine?
That's because it's a wimpy wine. it's also because when I was learning to make wine from my mentor, Joe Swan, he made Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Zinfandel. And Zinfandel, ironically, was his most successful grape, although he desperately wanted to be successful with Pinot Noir. And one night as we were sitting, you know, there drinking late, he said to me, he said, you're young. He says, you have choices to make. He says, I suggest that if you make the right choices, you will not make Pinot Noir. And, you know, while I took that to heart, you know, it was a bit of a driving factor. It wasn't the sole factor. I just happened to love Zinfandel so much, and it was so much the right grape for me that I ended up there. But I do have a son who's 25 who started making Pinot Noir, you know, when he was 5. And when I asked him why he wanted to make Pinot Noir, He said, because you said you'd never make it. So, see, I left the field open for somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's quite nice. That way his Pinot Noir will never be matched against yours in Fendel, hopefully. What about technological changes? You know, there's a lot of new technology that's been coming into the winemaking in the last 10 years or so, things like reverse osmosis machines that can be used to suck out various elements of the wine. Are you an advocate of that, and or have you used that sort of technology?
Well, I'm not an advocate of it per se. I mean, that sort of technology is a tool, and occasionally, you know, like medicine, you need medicine to take care of disease or illness. And I would say things like stuck fermentations or high VA or
volatile acids,
volatile acidity, vinegar, basically. Are issues with winemaking in some years, and so tools like that can help solve those problems. But when tools like that are used all the time, they make commodity wine, standard wine. They don't make wine that is really very interesting, wine that is interesting for people who really love to understand what soils and years and the winemaker's art is about. It would be the equivalent of a doctor, you know, saying, oh, well, this human being's born now. He's likely to get a disease sometime. Let's treat him with antibiotics his entire life. You know, it's just so he won't get anything.
Yeah.
Well, the truth of the matter is that that's not good medicine. And using the machines like this on a regular basis, you know, for anything except issues that are associated with problems, is bad medicine. I mean, it's bad winemaking at the end of the day.
And you think these sort of technologies, such as reverse osmosis to strip out alcohol and volatile acids, you think that's being maybe used a wee bit too much?
Well, I think it has a propensity to go in that direction, and people are using it more and more, and you're seeing more commonality between wines. I mean, everybody's shooting for what they consider perfection. So there's a certain alcohol level that's considered perfection. There's a certain sweetness level that's considered perfection. There's a certain color level that's considered perfection. Well, if those things are considered perfection, then all wines will be headed for, you know, that mythical perception of perfection, and it'll be completely boring. I mean, you don't want Chablis that tastes like, you know, Montrachet that tastes, you know, like Muscadet, for God's sakes. I mean, and in fact, you know, there's more compression in that kind of way, where this, you know, this mythical ideal, driven by, you know, maybe one or two wine writers, is what people shoot for. And while it may be commercially successful, it's incredibly boring.
Yep, for drinkers as well as makers, perhaps. All right, I think we'll wrap it up there, Joel.
Great.
Thank you very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the interview.
Cheers very much.